And to keep things rolling right along, I'd like to introduce to you Mariana Whitmer. Those of you in the Society for American Music will recognize in Mariana your executive director. She is also a project coordinator at the Center for American Music at the University of Pittsburgh, and she works with the Foster Collection. The title of her paper is Josiah K. Lilly and the Foster Hall Recordings. Please welcome Mariana.
Nathan, do we have a third speaker, or can I talk all morning? Okay. Just thought I'd check. Before I get started, I would just like to mention that when these recordings were made in the 1930s, there was no attempt made to alter the lyrics in any way. So I will apologize in advance. One of the examples I'm going to play is going to make us squirm a little bit in our seats because of the offensive language. So I apologize ahead of time. Josiah Kirby Lilly was born shortly before the onset of the Civil War in 1861 and died just after World War II in 1948. Living through three major wars, Lilly learned to deal with the sadness of departure and the grief of loss through his lifelong attachment to the music of Stephen Foster. Yet Josiah Lilly was also an innovative man of science and a shrewd business leader, and when these traits connected, our understanding and appreciation of Foster benefited. Josiah Lilly began working as an errand boy in his father's drug manufacturing company when he was 15. At that time, Eli Lilly and Company was primarily involved in producing elixirs, syrups, and fluid extracts. Recognizing the tremendous potential the industry held and understanding the need for additional training, Josiah left Indianapolis to attend the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy. Upon his return, he established the company's first scientific division, introducing significant innovations in research and manufacturing, which established Eli Lilly and Company as a leader in pharmaceutical production. When his father died in 1898, Josiah became president and turned his attention to expanding the company, both geographically and in the development of new products. Lilly was inspired to begin collecting early editions of his favorite composer just prior to his retirement in 1931 by a recording of Foster's music. With the same intelligence and sense of social obligation with which he ran his company, Lilly turned his attention to acquiring the works of Stephen Foster, maintaining the highest standards and meticulous business practices. Lilly originally stored his collection of what he called Fosteriana in a small building located on his property outside of Indianapolis. Originally a retreat for enjoying music, Harmony Hall, as it was called, featured a full-sized organ and an inscription at the threshold, which read, "Let no discordant note enter here." With the growth of the collection, however, the building was renamed Foster Hall, and the collection housed there became known as the Foster Hall Collection. Through Lilly's hard work and with the eventual assistance of 11 researchers, catalogers, and typists, the collection grew to include not only Foster's music, but correspondence, photographs, books about Foster in the South, and recordings. The main work of Foster Hall, however, was the compilation of an authoritative list of Foster's compositions, and when this was deemed complete in December of 1933, Lilly published the Foster Hall Reproductions, a complete collection of facsimiles of the first edition, or earliest obtainable edition, of Foster's complete works. Lilly dedicated them as, quote, "one of the major contributions of Foster Hall to a better knowledge of the work of America's greatest composer of beautiful melodies," unquote. 1,000 sets of the reproductions were published and distributed to libraries throughout the United States and Great Britain at no charge. The same month that Lilly completed the reproductions, he announced his intention to make phonograph records of every Foster song and instrumental composition. Lilly's plan was inspired by his love of Foster's music, but it was fueled by the lack of available recordings. At the time Lilly envisioned the Foster Hall recordings, existing discs of Foster were inadequate and poorly conceived. One study has shown that there were approximately 420 acoustic recordings made of Foster's music between 1895 and 1925, including wax cylinders and disc recordings. The artists who recorded Foster's music at this time represented a variety of professional and semi-professional singing groups, particularly quartets, in addition to minstrel and vaudeville singers. There were also a number of arrangements for instruments, either band or solo. and some novelty recordings, such as a unique arrangement of My Old Kentucky Home for woodsaw. Of these 400 plus recordings, however, only a very small fraction of Foster's music is represented, 14 songs out of a known repertoire of over 200, and none of his instrumental works. The majority of these are Foster's so-called plantation songs, which were extremely popular. As you can see in the table in your handout, and I'm hoping everybody did get a handout, there were some up front and some out back. As you can see in the table in your handout, the predominant songs were Old Folks at Home, recorded the most number of times, My Old Kentucky Home, Old Black Joe, and Masses in the Cold, Cold Ground. Sorry. By the early 1930s, Lilly had established his own sizable collection of Foster recordings, many in several different languages. The Old Folks at Home in Danish, for example, and O Susanna in Japanese. Lilly's collection reflects the overall trend in Foster recordings, including many of the same songs, in arrangements with titles such as Plantation Medley, Medley of Old Southern Melodies, and Minstrel Melodies. They appear with titles like Songs from the Cotton Fields, or my favorite, Darky Land Ditties by the Plantation Melody Makers. This predominance of only a limited selection of Foster's songs did nothing to enhance the public's understanding of Foster's music. In this recording of Rosa Poncel's Old Folks at Home, for example, we can hear the stylized arrangement characteristic of these renditions by opera singers, especially in the over-dramatized tempi and melodic lines. Sounds like the woodsaw. Familiar with Foster's original manuscripts and editions, Lilly was likely disillusioned with the small sampling and misrepresentation of Foster's talent that was currently available on disc. His desire to provide a recorded rendition of the original published versions, a complete works on disc, so to speak, led him to commission the Foster Hall recordings, 96 discs recorded by a small group of amateur musicians at the Jeanette Recording Laboratories, containing all of Foster's songs, hymns, and instrumental music as Lilly knew them at the time. The choice of performers for this endeavor immediately distinguished it from all other extant recordings of Foster's music. Led by Mrs. Luella Clayton Kahn of Dayton, Ohio, these were non-professional yet talented singers. As a member of the Westminster Presbyterian Church Choir and the choir director of the Reed Memorial Church in Richmond, Indiana, she was no doubt familiar with the local talent and knew which voices would best suit for Lilly's project. The small group of amateur vocalists she engaged to complete these recordings, and a list is included in your handout, has since faded into obscurity, and nothing more is known of them. With the exception of the flautist and the accompanist, who also recorded the solo piano works, the instrumentalists are completely unnamed. The music included in the Foster Hall recordings reflect what was in the collection and considered the complete works of Stephen Foster as they were known in 1933. Of the 208 works that are now included in the critical edition, compiled by Stephen Saunders and Dean Root in 1990, almost all of them are recorded. An examination of the pieces which were recorded and which were left out reflects Lilly's desire to present Foster's music accurately. Although Lilly initially sent Mrs. Kahn copies of the Foster Hall reproductions, intending that the musicians use these definitive versions or editions, the ensemble headed to the local library, where they found a more efficient solution in the form of the single-volume edition by Morrison Foster, Stephen's brother. Morrison's Biography, Songs, and Musical Compositions of Stephen C. Foster was published in Pittsburgh in 1896 and represents all of Foster's songs, which were known to Morrison in 1860. The music is the same as the editions of the reproductions, but in a smaller format, preferred especially by the accompanist, who found it easier to handle. When they requested additional copies of Morrison's biography from Foster Hall, Lily, who was always careful with his materials, sent her a copy of the more recent but equivalent Melodies of Stephen C. Foster by T.M. Walker, published in Pittsburgh in 1909. As Lily explained to Mrs. Kahn, this edition is an exact reproduction of Morrison Foster's, differing only in the order of the music. With the exception of some of the hymns and other songs not included in Morrison's collection, it was from this work that Mrs. Kahn and her colleagues recorded. However, Mrs. Kahn utilized the reproductions as her guide and determined what should or should not be included based on Foster Hall's classifications. Lily's implicit intent, as reflected in the recordings, was to include only Foster's original works. There are three categories of non-original works listed in the index to the reproductions: arrangements, including Foster's rearrangements of his own works; adaptations, those songs with Foster's new text set to existing tunes; and what Lily termed derivata. As will be seen, some of Lily's designations were problematic and raised questions during the recording. In addition to the many guitar arrangements Foster made of his songs, Lily's extensive list of arrangements includes the instrumental arrangements, solos, duets, trios, and quartets, based on tunes by various other composers, as well as Foster's instrumental arrangements of his own songs. To record all of these works, 102 by Lily's count, would likely have been inordinately expensive and also inconsistent with his desire to record only Foster's original compositions. However, many of these instrumental arrangements of his songs are rarely heard, and the quartet arrangements for flute, two violins, and cello are especially interesting. The most unfortunate loss in this category is Foster's Old Folks Quadrilles, a group of five short instrumental dance pieces based on the melodies of Old Folks at Home, Oh Boys Carry Me Long, Nellie Bly, and Farewell My Lily Dear. The fifth movement, however, entitled Canebrake Jig, is an original tune, and Foster's version for solo piano was included in the recordings. And I'm going to play that for you now. It is apparent in the correspondence between Lily and Mrs. Kahn that she questioned the wisdom of not recording at least two of the three works listed as adaptations, and these are listed in your handout. She first questions Lily about the two hymns, We'll Tune Our Hearts and The Pure, the Bright, and the Beautiful, which share the same tune. Mrs. Kahn was instructed to record both and quickly went about making sure she was clear on the other adaptations as well. Quote, since you have made this decision, will you also want recorded Praise the Lord, set to Foster's tune Willie's Gone to Heaven? If so, I would suggest they be recorded on the same record, as both are very short. This would keep them apart from the set of original compositions, unquote. Lily agreed, and these adaptations were included in the recordings. The diligent Mrs. Kahn even discovered another adaptation previously unknown to the Foster Hall staff, and writes to Lily that the melody of The White House Chair is almost identical to that of The Merry, Merry Month of May. This caused a certain amount of excitement in Foster Hall, and after some research, it was determined that The White House Chair was composed first in 1856. Foster then recycled the tune for The Merry, Merry Month of May, a song first published in the children's periodical The Clark's School Visitor in 1862. In his introduction to the reproductions, Lily defined derivata, and the technical name is derivata fosteriana, as, quote, a classification of songs, the words of which were written by others using the music of a Foster song, unquote. With great understatement, Lily added, quote, their number is legion, unquote, and reproduced only what he considered to be the 10 most important. And this listing of five songs and five hymns appears on your handout. Not recording the derivata was a prudent decision. However, there is one problematic omission with regard to While the Bowl Goes Round, which is set to the same tune as Foster's Jenny June. It is listed as derivata in the reproductions, yet the text is by George Cooper. George Cooper contributed the words to the original Jenny June, as well as many of Foster's other songs, which are listed with Foster's original works. Lily knew the text was by Cooper, so its listing as derivata is rather mysterious. All of Foster's original instrumental works, and these are also listed on your handout, are heard on the recordings with one exception. Autumn Waltz was unknown to Lilly and only came to the attention of the collection in 1988. It was established as a work of Foster's through the careful examination of Dean Root. Although we were denied the instrumental arrangement of the old folks' quadrilles, we are fortunate that Foster wrote other instrumental dance pieces. The Village Festival Quadrilles, for example, is included in the recordings, and although the tunes differ from its old folks' counterpart, the instrumentation is the same and the style is similar. Doubtful works included in the recordings outnumber the three original ones left out. Five works, which are now considered to be not Foster's, appear in the Foster Hall recordings, and in these instances, Lilly's lack of musical knowledge may have led him astray. Two of the songs, Long Ago Day and This Rose Will Remind You, were acquired in manuscript format from Dean Rice, grandson of T.D. Rice, the minstrel performer who popularized Jump Jim Crow. Lilly had them published in 1931 and was so excited about This Rose Will Remind You that he had extra copies pressed of this recording and had it sent to several friends. Root and Saunders have shown that these two works deviate from Foster's musical style and thus are most likely not original compositions. All Day Long, although published with Foster's name, is overshadowed by evidence that similarly warranted closer examination, as established in the critical edition. The publisher was not one typically used by Foster, a likely indicator of a fraudulent composition. Neither does this song appear in Morrison's edition of Stephen's Music. Lilly, unable to perceive the stylistic anomalies that cast further doubt on Foster's authorship, thought it was an original and included it in the reproductions and the recordings. Conversely, it is surprising that Little Mac, You're the Very Man, which Lilly and the Foster staff knew was not by Foster, was included in the Foster Hall recordings. As Lilly noted in the index to the Foster Hall reproductions, the lyrics of Little Mac referred to the 1864 Democratic presidential and vice presidential nominees who were not nominated until 7 months after Foster's death. Perhaps Lilly considered this an original composition since the music combines quotations from Foster's Nellie Bly and Better Times Are Coming. But since the lyrics are decidedly not by Foster, perhaps this song belongs in the category of derivata. Lilly's reasons for considering this an original work are unclear. Finally, the Tioga Waltz, which is included in the recordings, is now considered to be of questionable authenticity since we do not have an authoritative manuscript or published source. It was originally printed in Morrison Foster's biography based on Morrison's recollection of its original performance. As Morrison notes in the biography, quote, "It has never previously been published and is only now reproduced from my memory where it has lain for 50 years," unquote. With this recording of the Tioga Waltz and these other doubtful works, the Foster Hall recordings offers the opportunity to appreciate Foster wannabes along with the authentic works. When considered alongside the known recordings of Foster songs from this era, the Foster Hall recordings reveal how distant the other interpretations were from Foster's original intentions, and also how easily these songs lend themselves to different interpretations. The Foster Hall recordings maintain a strict adherence to the stylistic indications of the printed music, and thus probably represent the most accurate renditions available of Foster's compositions. Although verses are frequently left out due to the short duration of recording time, all of the dialect is included, and none of the text that we now consider objectionable or offensive is altered in any way. The dichotomy between Foster's minstrel songs and parlor songs is almost non-existent in the Foster Hall recordings. "O Susanna" and "Ring de Banjo" are sung with enthusiasm, but without any attempt to apply a stylized minstrel interpretation. Meanwhile, "Old Folks at Home," "Old Black Joe," "I Cannot Sing Tonight," and "Ah, May the Red Rose Live Alway" are sung with an equal amount of sentimentality and pathos. Although perhaps necessary, this impartial or neutral interpretation of the songs can be dreary, as evident when the recording of "Away Down South," sung by the Foster Hall Quartet, is compared with the version on the Foster Hall recording. So I will play first the example of the Foster Hall Quartet. Foster Hall Quartet was a quartet that Josiah Lilly employed on a casual basis to sing for business associates and friends.
We'll put the South, and that's the place for the steeple chase and the bully horse race.
Poker bragging your car, seven up and loose, then chime in, darkies want to come along too.
No use talking while the darkies want to go. While the corn comes out the many game break throw. Then come along to Cuba, hammer dance the poker Cuba.
Wait a while,
while the corn grows. No use talking when the darky wants to go. While the corn comes out the many game break throw. Then come along to Cuba, hammer dance the poker Cuba.
Wait. My love, she has a...
And this is a recording on the Foster Hall recordings.
We'll put for the South, for that's the place for the steeple chase and the bully horse race. Poker, brag, euchre, seven up and loo, then chime in, niggers, won't you come along too?
No use talking when the nigger wants to go. Where the corn comes blossom and the cane may grow.
Then come along to Cuba and we'll dance the polka Cuba.
Wait and stop
while the corn grows.
You can tell that the Foster Hall Quartet took some liberties with the structure of the song and included more repetition, and whereas the Foster Hall recording was a little more tame and exactly what was on the printed page. Do these recordings offer us a legacy of Foster's music as he intended it to be sung, or do they provide us with a baseline from which we may become familiar with the songs enough to provide our own interpretations? Foster understood that many of his songs, particularly his early Ethiopian melodies, would be subjected to different instrumentation and interpretations, so perhaps there is no correct answer. William Austin points out in his book, Susanna, Jeannie, and the Old Folks at Home, that the melody of the songs was of utmost importance to Foster. How it was interpreted was perhaps not as critical. Lilly may not have been as concerned with the interpretation as he was with simply making the songs available to counteract the misrepresentation of Foster's music so prevalent in existing recordings. Turning to the more technical aspects of the recordings, Lilly's intent to preserve Foster's music on this medium for posterity was evident from the very beginning of his correspondence with Harry Jeanette Jr. at Jeanette Recording Company. At the very onset, Lilly established specific physical criteria for the recordings, including long life for unused records, long usefulness of used records, and storage capabilities so they will remain flat and not warp. Ever a realist, Lilly admitted to Jeanette that it was possible no one would ever listen to them, but communicated his desire that they last forever nevertheless. Lilly's physical requirements led to much discussion concerning the materials of which these discs were made. 1934 was a transition year in the development of recorded sound, and this is evident in the correspondence as different types of materials were considered for the Foster Hall recordings. Although high-quality shellac was mentioned as the eventual material for these records, in March 1934, Jeanette began pressing with a regular shellac formula. Midway through the recording process in July 1934, Lilly and Jeanette began discussing metal records, and Lilly is offered the option of copper with chromium plating or copper with nickel plating. In a letter to Jeanette in August, he writes that they are, quote, getting into the habit of using only fiber needles at the hall so as never to get metal needles onto your records, unquote. That Lilly had decided on metal records for the finished product is evident from a letter to the International Record Agency 3 months later. He writes, quote, Jeanette is getting along very well with the records. The musical work is being done by members of the Westminster Choir at Dayton, and the finished records will be on copper, chromium plated, unquote. After the recordings were completed, slightly less than a year later, in April 1935, Jeanette writes to Lilly that he has an alternative material to the metal records and sent Lilly a sample pressed from a new material, which may have been a nitrate compound. Although it is more expensive, the new material would cut the cost of the finished records in half due to the fact that the pressings could be made double-sided. Jeanette describes the benefits of this new material. It is lighter than the ordinary shellac stock. It is non-flammable and practically non-breakable. Appealing to Lilly's experience as a scientist, he suggests that he, quote, give this record any tests that you might desire and advise me as to your opinion of its quality, unquote. He also enclosed special needles, different from the fiber needle, which was, quote, of course, being used on the chrome-plated metal record, unquote. A little over a month later, a memo from one of Lilly's staff indicates that they ran tests not against the metal records, but against a Victor record, quote, for 60 times, and wished to report that the trial record did not hold up as well as the Victor. It became scratchy and there was evidence of much surface noise, unquote. The decision of which material to use was postponed. Defending his new product, Jeanette's reply implies that the conditions under which the record was tested may not have been fair. He concedes that the Victor record, made from a quality shellac, would, quote, possibly make a better showing, unquote. However, he reiterates in detail how this material would meet all of Lilly's criteria for long life and encourages Lilly, the test notwithstanding, to go with a nitrate compound. Lilly conceded a few days later, and the metal records were never mentioned again. The metal samples still reside in the Foster Hall collection, and one can see that the weight of these records alone make them terribly impractical, although they look like they will last forever. And I did bring a metal record with me, so if anyone would like to stay after the session and take a look at it, I would certainly appreciate all comments and suggestions. Recorded 70 years after Foster's death, we now consider the Foster Hall recordings from a similar vantage point, 70 years after they were recorded. Unlike the Foster Hall reproductions, Lilly had only 10 copies of the Foster Hall recordings pressed, and these were deposited in key locations. Not intended for general public consumption, these recordings exist as a unique source for all of Foster's music, in the original arrangement and without extraneous interpretation. Included on these discs are the only renditions of many of Foster's parlor songs, songs such as I Cannot Sing Tonight, which expands our repertoire of Foster songs as it enhances our appreciation of his vast talent. Stephen Foster Memorial, there is a tribute to Josiah Lilly engraved on the wall. It reads in part, quote, as a boy, he found comfort and courage and joy in the songs of Stephen Collins Foster. In payment of this unpayable debt, he gathered the facts of Foster's life and of his songs in the Foster Hall collection, unquote. We are fortunate indeed that Lilly demonstrated his gratitude by creating this remarkable legacy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mariana. Since you are staying after, maybe I wonder if you might defer some questions until that
sure.
time.
Absolutely.
Okay.